You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on January 26th, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss a big idea for America, a free public college system. Then we look at the Greek election results and implications. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me in studio this week as the blizzard rolls in is my co-host, Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
So the past week we saw the formal introduction of President Obama's education plans, particularly with regard to community colleges. They were sort of debuted a little bit before the State of the Union and then mentioned again in the State of the Union, and then he gave a speech in Tennessee about this. And this has been sort of a relatively limited, although still ambitious by what's expected to actually be feasible, proposal here, which is that community college would be made. There would be a free community college option for anyone in the country, basically, I think, for a two-year program. And, you know, again, this is somewhat ambitious in terms of, like, it's actually a substantive, large-scale proposal that would affect a lot of people, potentially, and probably isn't going to get very far with the Republican majority. But it has sparked a lot of questions about sort of the broader picture of where we should be looking on education reform, and various folks have raised a lot of points, in particular the blogger Zaid Jilani, who's worked for various left-leaning think tanks and stuff and is, you know, pretty, I would say, vocally left on a lot of stuff. He kind of argued that President Obama relied very heavily on students to win, not just the general elections both times, but also the win the primary against Hillary Clinton in 2008, and yet he hasn't done like a lot for students relative to how important they were. And in fact, Democrats in general don't seem to do as much as you would expect for how much students play a role in Democratic politics. And that's, you know, sort of an interesting thing that I hadn't even really thought a whole lot about. You know, even as I think, you know, this show is sort of a geared toward that exact demographic, young people and students, and the issues that matter to that group, which we fall into still, not students anymore, but young people. So, you know, some folks are saying, well, why not look at the bigger picture? Why not, you know, have a free option of some kind for four-year colleges? And that's kind of what we wanted to talk about today, you know, comparing those two options, the president's more limited proposal and that more, you know, wide-reaching proposal, as well as some other ideas. Nate, what was your take initially on the president's proposal? You know, upsides, downsides, what was your initial reaction to this?
Yeah, I think it's a decent step forward. I mean, we've talked for a while. I mean, it seems like ever since the beginning of the Obama presidency about, you know, like the idea of more affordable community colleges, moving towards more like, I guess you could say, European-style system where, you know, the cost wasn't the main factor in terms of what college you're choosing to go to. So, I mean, just to throw things back over to Europe, so, you know, whether it's France, whether it's England, there are a large number of public universities where you can go to and not pay a huge tuition. Basically, like, if you have good enough grades, you'll be able to get in. I don't think there are standardized tests. There might be some standardized testing, at least, yeah, France is the back, so, you know. But it's not like this massive, it's almost like an industry. It's a complex or a bubble sort of that we've seen in terms of the college rates in the U.S. because it goes up by a couple thousand each year for these elite universities. And, you know, for a lot of people, and this was the case for, you know, some of my friends at school, you just, it required a lot of student loans. And luckily, some people got, you know, financial assistance that didn't require loans because of various endowments and such. But if you don't have that and you're taking out loans and you're, you know, trying to pay $50,000 a year, then, or and it's now higher, probably like 55, maybe going to 60 at some point. So, you know, that's extremely difficult. And, you know, maybe that's not the best option for everyone. Maybe that might be more, I mean, I don't want to say cost efficient for, and this is not necessarily a dichotomy between the $50,000, you know, private university and free community college, but there's all sorts of, you know, things in between and costs in between. So maybe it just makes more financial sense for someone to go to community college. If you're coming out, or if you're able to do that more easily because of the Obama program, that might be good.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there's sort of Europe certainly has more options at various levels, but also there's certainly, I think, in countries like Germany, you've got that vocational focus, which has sort of fallen a little bit by the wayside in the United States. Now, again, not, you know, vocational options aren't necessarily good for everyone, but at the by the same token, you know, the traditional four-year programs aren't either. And also, we've seen huge leaps and bounds in what community colleges can potentially offer, you know, even within the scope of a two-year program or transition into a four-year program in recent years.
Yeah, Rahm Emanuel, obviously former White House chief of staff, you know, is now mayor of Chicago, and he has undertaken a reform of sort of like the community college program there, just because he has, as you said, connected sort of a more vocational ideal where he's connecting it to various businesses in the area. So IT, healthcare, you know, manufacturing, hospitality, transportation, logistics. Apparently, you know, you're cross-training too. So if you like, have got some auto mechanics, you need the IT training to fix today's smart cars, basically. So, you know, it's all that, you know, it's, you're trying to actually move this sort of education towards the 20th century, get real specialized in like the critical fields that are going to be important. And to do that, you don't necessarily need a four-year education in this highly specialized liberal arts field. You might just need, you know, on-the-job training or practical training, a practical instruction. It's, you know, various jobs require different types of expertise and training. So it's, you know, a community college could be the perfect setting for that kind of training.
Yeah. Now, to go again to the bigger picture, this, you know, 2 year versus 4 year. So the essentially what the president's proposal is to try to create at least a parallel option that establishes a K through, you know, 14 level education system, public education system. Not everyone's going to be going to those last 2 years on, you know, the public dime, but some would. And the question then becomes, well, in this modern era, why should the focus stop at K through 12? Why should it even stop at K through 14? You know, you can potentially raise money issues, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But, you know, fundamentally, if we decided that, you know, first we decided that, you know, primary school needed to be available publicly for everyone, and then we decided that, you know, middle school and high school, and we decided that kindergarten, and then there's been some pushes for, you know, more public funding for pre-K, and the question is, why have we made the decision to stop at, you know, 12th grade, knowing that in the current economy, almost everyone's going to need at least 2 more years, if not 4 more years of education to be able to be sort of economically competitive, not just nationally, but globally. And that's where the question becomes, okay, well, why isn't there a movement to push for K through 16? And I guess part of it's that, as Nate said, college has become such a big business, like a profitable enterprise, so to speak, you know, even for nonprofit colleges and even state colleges have definitely been kind of milking some of the population for tuition and various things like that. But that doesn't really address the fundamental question, which is that really the direction that we want to be going in, or should we have a public option in you know, available next to these various private options and other things like that, and have that be federally funded or partly federally, partly state funded? one of the other big problems is that we had such a great state system. You know, you'd hear people talking about, you know, oh, back in my day, you could go to college for $5,000 or whatever, right? And that was usually like a state school, like one of the big, huge flagship ones. And that's just not a reality anymore at all. I mean, even for the in-state kids, it's usually going to be at least three times more than that. And some of the private colleges, you know, even obviously some of the elite ones have, you know, the cost of going there has increased by 10 times over a 30-year period.
Yeah, it increases by also a couple $1,000s each year, too. So that just shows you it's keep going up.
Right. And, you know, there's been a lot of controversies about systems like in California, you know, having to raise their tuitions, even for the in-state kids, pretty dramatically. That's caused a lot of protests and disruptions. Here in Massachusetts, where we're recording and where Nate and I are both from, the University of Massachusetts system, you know, they've also, I think, had to raise some prices. But more worryingly, actually, is that they, because of their sort of cost constraints and how they have to admit, you know, certain number of people from Massachusetts, they've run into problems where people can get in, right? But then they can't sign up for the classes that they need. So it takes them, you know, more than 4 years, even if they're doing everything they can to get out on time, it's going to take them more than 4 years to get all their required classes in to, you know, finish their major. We know someone who is at one of the University of Massachusetts schools who has who found herself in that position, certainly. And that is definitely a real concern. And a lot of the budgets have been cut back even further. As the population going into them is growing, they've been cut because they're sort of state controlled and federally, you know, the federal government hands them a grant and then they can kind of do whatever with it. And that has led them to use that during, you know, tough times like we saw during the recession to cut the budgets, the education budgets of higher education in their state. And so that's that sort of motivating factor for maybe we should consider having, not saying like, oh, everyone's education should be paid for guaranteed, or that, you know, every school should be free. Like, that's not the proposal here. The idea is, why not have a federalized version of those land grants, you know, maybe actually federalize the existing ones or one in each state or something like that, and have that, you know, 4 years that you can, like, your tuition is zero. It's obviously, when you say free college, that makes it sound like, well, you're not paying attention to the actual cost. No, the idea is that the federal government's going to pick up the tab for that. And presumably, much in the way that Medicare, you know, can negotiate down various costs because it's the one single buyer, this would be like a single payer education system where they could help control and regulate the costs to make sure that there's at least always one school in each state that's going to be at an affordable level, or even free, I should say, but that its actual costs of operation are affordable and not getting out of control. Because that's been a big problem too, is just the costs keep going up, you know, sort of artificially inflating, not because the actual costs have risen, but because they just say, oh, well, you know, if we raise it more, the students will just get more loans and more subsidies and things like that. I wanted to talk a little bit about that angle as well. What do you think about the sort of where we're going with the student loans at this point? We've talked about this before on this show a little bit, but is the federal student loan system actually helping to make college more affordable, or is it just causing more problems on balance than, say, a free tuition system?
Right. Well, if we're winding up with a lot of students heavily in debt, that's not a good scenario. Obviously, credit card debt was a huge problem the past couple of years. That helped spark our sort of Great Recession or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so we just don't want to create scenarios where we have heavily indebted young people that really, you know, that limits their, you know, where they can work. You know, they need to get money to pay off their loans as fast as possible, I guess. It just sort of interferes with everything. And you had a good point about the public option. Obviously, we didn't get the public option for healthcare, but, you know, if that is a separate option. So obviously we're not looking to replace every single college and university in America with, you know, free public institutions, whatever. That's just not happening and it's not practical, whatever. But to have that option, maybe not the worst idea. I mean, it would probably have to be like a state option per state, you know, maybe a couple different, an extension of the state university system or whatever, but just ways of, you know, fitting in people or, you know, trying to make college more affordable for people that wouldn't be able to do it. And then even if they were able to, you know, get student loans or whatever, they might get buried under those student loans. So is that even better than necessarily, you know, trying to, you know, pay them all off? Or is it just better to go to a more free or accessible community college, four-year college, whatever, in order to get their education that way?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there's a lot of problems posed by the student debt burden. You know, student debt is one of the few or only things that can't be discharged through bankruptcy. There was an article, I think, in The Atlantic today commenting on the fact that it's sort of bizarre that the student loan repayment structure is still so one-size-fits-all. I mean, they're starting to come out with some sort of alternative options, you know, but they're a little bit patchwork. In general, it's basically like you owe the same amount effectively no matter what your circumstances are, which doesn't really take into account, you know, some people have double incomes, some people don't have double incomes, some people are working really high-paying jobs and can pay the loans right off, some people are working, you know, much less well-paying jobs. Either way, if people are stuck paying these, you know, huge bills every month, that's money that can't be going into savings accounts for later big purchases. It can't be going toward, you know, buying a house. It can't be going toward just general consumer spending that we, you know, had come to count on in the economy. And that's going to be a major shift that we see with the, you know, millennial generation, which as of 2015 is going to outweigh the size of the baby boomers, because the baby boomers peaked in 1999 and then, you know, some of them are passing away. And so this is the first time now where we're going to see our generation is going to be bigger than one of the other generations and is going to have substantially different, you know, spending habits and things like that by necessity because of how big these issues have gotten. And if we don't change anything, it's going to be then the next generation behind us is also going to be in the same boat. So, you know, the cost of college has gone way up, and I think that, you know, and it's changing, the student loans problem has gone way up. I also find it, as I've said before, a little bit problematic, or a lot problematic, that you can have 18-year-olds or whatever signing up for, you know, $50,000 loans or loans that might balloon to $100,000 depending on how long it takes to pay off, and that sort of thing. Like, why are we allowing basically teenagers to do that when we don't allow them to, you know, we don't even allow them to drink, right? Like, legally.
Let's get into a discussion about that too.
Well, but my point being that, like, if you're willing to let them make these huge sort of life altering economic decisions when you're not willing to let them make all kinds of other decisions, we don't even give out credit cards with, you know, anywhere near those limits of debt, right? It's much, much lower limits. And so that sort of thing, it just doesn't really make any sense. And then I think there's been a lot of evidence that these programs have tended to benefit, you know, middle class, even upper middle class people. And then the colleges, as I said, have taken advantage of that by saying, okay, well, we'll just raise our, you know, tuition or raise various fees, and then it'll just take out more student loans to cover it. Problem solved, right? I think if we had a sort of public option in each state, a federal public option for four-year college, that would at least put a lot of cost pressure on to keep, you know, keep the costs from going up at the various schools, because there would be that, you know, that other option that more people could go to. It would probably need to be more than one, I'm guessing, in some states, just because there would be too much demand. But that's kind of the general concept there. Also, to your point, you were saying kind of on implementation, like, would it be federal or would it be state? I mean, that's part of the thing that I think would be interesting. I know a lot of Republicans don't want to do like a federal program like this, but it, you know, from a business perspective, it would probably be great if you had a standardized, you know, school system across the country. You know, not like every school is the same, but that there was one of these schools in every state, because then you could move around from state to state, and potentially that starts to, you know, re-increase labor mobility, which has become a big problem lately. You know, people are trapped with, you know, home mortgages, or they're trapped with, you know, healthcare plans that are tied to their employers. And so we've seen those disjunctions where some areas of the country have a big demand for jobs, And some areas of the country, there are, you know, way more people looking for jobs than there are jobs. And we used to solve this by people literally just packing up all their stuff and then moving across the country to start a new life. You know, that was sort of the quintessential idea of the frontier, right? But we can't do that anymore if people are stuck in various locations. So it might be interesting to have a sort of federalized education system that, like, you could go between states and it wouldn't necessarily be dependent on your, you know, your in-state residency or whatever, right? You wouldn't have to be thinking about that kind of thing all the time. You could just say, okay, like, I'm going to be able to get a part-time job over here that's in my relevant field or something, or I could go work in the, you know, do an internship at a relevant enterprise near this school, and it would be the same education that I'd get in my own state, but the opportunities would be better for my career development, things like that. Those are sort of interesting concepts that I think we might see emerge from a system like this. Now, in terms of cost, there was a Think Progress article by Bryce Covert on January 9th. It says how Obama could make college free for everyone without spending a dime. Obviously, the not spending a dime part refers to reallocating a bunch of money from how it's currently being spent. But essentially, without even the cost of student loans, which is now $197.4 billion federal expenditure each year, even setting that aside, the amount that we currently spend on, quote, subsidizing the cost of college through grants, tax breaks, and work-study funds, use that money and instead cover all the tuition at all public colleges, which would be a much bigger thing than even what we're talking about here, that amount of money costs $69 billion a year for the government, and the tuition at all public colleges, like the state colleges in 2012, was $62.6 billion. So we already are actually spending more money on various, you know, tax breaks and grants and subsidies to these public colleges than it would cost to provide, you know, make a zero tuition system at all the state colleges. For another point of comparison, I looked up to see, you know, some of the defense spending to see how that compares with this. And this would be like, you know, still well below the overall federal, you know, defense spending levels and things like that annually. It would actually be less than just the procurement budget of the Pentagon each year. It would be larger than the Marine Corps budget, though, which is, I found that interesting because that's $40 billion a year versus $62 billion a year for this. But, you know, I think this raises an interesting point. Yes, this would be a significant amount of money for the federal government to spend, but we already do spend it on education-related costs and higher education-related costs specifically. So, you know, from a cost perspective, does this break the bank?
I mean, it could potentially be decently expensive, but when you add up all the various other costs of, you know, whether it's all these various loan programs and, you know, we had a lot of expense with the whole middleman system in terms of student loans, where you were sort of loaning through various, they weren't really banks. They were sort of, how would you describe them?
There were these private lenders.
Yeah.
And the U.S. was like guaranteeing the loans or something.
Yeah, and it, yeah. I mean, it ended up being fairly expensive for the U.S. And obviously it was not a good situation for the students themselves. So, you know, there are costs associated with doing it the way that we have been doing it. So, you know, it's not like, and this would probably just be an outgrowth, I would say, of the current public university system, would you say? Like, it would be weird to start something, like, completely
right.
separate from it. So you wonder, like, if there are ways that you could sort of start this on a smaller scale and then build up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, pilot programs certainly seem conceivable.
Or, like, pilot classes, pilot, like, you know, curriculums, and then building from that into, like, an actual school with multi-departments and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about the student loans, so, you know, that was something that did happen in terms of a student-oriented reform. This was part of the sort of health reform package just to come up with, make the numbers work for that. They saved the federal government money by taking out the middleman, as Nate said. And that's the part that adds up now to, you know, $197.4 billion a year on student loans. And there's been a lot of criticism that that's the part, as I mentioned before, that is helping, you know, upper middle class kids or, you know, solidly middle class kids go to elite universities, you know, that they don't necessarily need to go and they wouldn't be able to afford to go to it without student loans. And I guess that would be controversial, right? Of basically telling people, like, we're not going to keep paying for you to go to those schools, but instead you'd be providing them these, you know, instead of in the form of loans, you'd be providing them zero tuition option at these public universities. That's where folks used to go a lot of the time before the sort of student loan programs really ballooned into such a huge industry, even a government industry. So that's a potentially a big savings as well, that you could really, you know, invest in these public colleges all over the country and then send people to those and also send people, you know, to community college. And, you know, then it would sort of like if you didn't want to go to that, you'd just, you know, if you had the means, you'd just pony up and go to, you know, one of these elite schools. But that's you'd have to figure out your own funding for that. And you'd be getting a perfectly adequate, competent education at one of these public colleges, I think. So, you know, it seems like the student loan system has kind of gotten a little bit out of control and in some ways has made itself unnecessary. It's not accomplishing the goal that it was meant to do, which was make college affordable for lower income folks. Now, one thing about both this proposal that President Obama has made, the community college one, as well as a sort of broader four-year proposal like we're talking about, there has been some criticism that this would, again, be a program that would probably benefit mostly middle-class people instead of, you know, lower-income folks who have trouble getting to, you know, have trouble affording to go to these various programs. Do you think that this is something that should be, you know, means tested or have a cap, or do you think that it should be available to everyone? My inclination is make it available to everyone so that it's not a controversial, you know, wealth transfer program.
Well, from yeah, the and class. Then like the whole means testing thing is always extremely problematic, and I'm not a huge fan of. And like just to jump sort of aside, like means testing was like I guess kind of a buzzword in like parliamentary debate. Like, that was sort of a way to sanitize a program. Like, I don't know how to best describe it, but it's a way to sort of limit and, like, encapsulate a program from criticism, I feel like, just as you said, so it's not a wealth transfer. But at the same time, I don't feel like that's necessarily the most optimal use of resources and the best way to get, you know, the best student body. Because if we're just looking at the people that are, you know, literally can't go to another school, it's like, okay, then we'll take those people. But what about people that, you know, they may have enough money to go to a different school, but they would rather spend or be able to save some money or, you know, not spend an exorbitant amount on education, especially maybe if they're looking for a more technical field where they're not, you know, need a four-year degree. They're just looking for, you know, specialization and skills and stuff. So, you know, it's I wouldn't say means testing, but obviously, right. You can't necessarily open it to everybody because then you just have like a giant enrollment. So it'd definitely be a difficult process to sort through everyone.
Yeah, I mean, some systems like state level systems have used various lotteries, I think, to kind of limit the number of people that get into these programs. But I'm not sure that's necessarily fair either. I tend to lean more toward the angle that we could probably afford to send a lot of people, like a fairly significant chunk of people, and then everyone else would kind of self-select out. Like if they genuinely had the means, they'll probably go to somewhere that has more, you know, cachet, so to speak, you know. But if they need it, you know, or even if we're not sure that they need it, like what's the real harm in doing this, right? Open it up to everyone, make it available to everyone. And it's just like how we let everyone go to public schools in this country, but there are also still private schools for, you know, the high school level and even elementary school level, right? And so some people are always going to go to those ones. And those schools can also offer various, you know, scholarship type things to have some, you know, lower income folks at those. But why not have this open? Why not have a K through 16, you know, public, like at least that option available for everyone? You know, we don't necessarily know. It can be a little bit, you know, of an illusion, even with the current stuff like the FAFSA and things like that, of saying, okay, well, this person, you know, their parents have this amount of money, so therefore their parents can afford to. And it's like, well, not everyone's getting money from their parents. And then beyond that, you know, what if the parents have some cost that can't be reflected on, you know, easily in the thing, right? There could be an elderly relative that's going to need a lot of care coming up in, you know, a couple of years or something like that, right? So, like, I don't know that there's necessarily a huge harm in saying, you know, let's just let everyone have this option. That doesn't mean they all have to go there. That doesn't mean they all will go there, but let's have that option available.
Yeah, and I think if that option was available, we might see, just a little bit less of this, I guess you could say, student debt crisis. And this, you mentioned an article in The Atlantic a little while ago. There was another article a couple years back, but it was like by a professor. It was basically saying that, you know, not everyone should go to college. And like, it was kind of in a, like, I wouldn't say elitist, but like, it could have come off that way. But it was also like, I felt like it made some decent points just like by relaying various stories of, and it had some like more data and more substantive things to back it up, but like relaying various stories of students that just like didn't get it, where they needed to write a paper, they didn't really understand how to write that paper, and it was just sort of situations where like maybe these people, they're not best suited for a four-year university. It might be a better, just overall for them, they might enjoy it more if it was a like a more specialized program where they're doing something there and getting like more hands-on experience, something they actually care about more than sort of writing, you know, because, you know, in college there's like all these papers you have to write and there's like a bunch of different course requirements, so you have to take classes a bunch of different areas and you end up writing papers about stuff that like maybe you don't really care about all that much, so you're just sort of writing to write, and if you're not really quite engaged enough to be in college in the first place, then it might be even harder. So, you know, you might want to just avoid a scenario where that's the case and try to focus people on what, you know, is actually the most important for them.
All right. Well, Nate, that closes out this topic. Arsenal for Democracy. We'll be right back. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. In studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the Greek elections, which were held on Sunday, January 25th. These were historic elections won by a party that had never won before, Syriza. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about their coalition partner, and we're going to talk a little bit about what Greece might be able to expect as a result of this change. So the sort of fundamental question that was being posed by this election was, you know, on a sort of more scary level, can modern Greek democracy survive the effects of the, you know, extraordinary fiscal mismanagement that happened in Greece for many decades by both of the major parties, then a devastating recession, then the, you know, austerity policies, that sudden day of reckoning. A lot of that was being pushed by Berlin. And we saw kind of the fundamental collapse of the major party system in Greece. PASOK, the Socialist Party, basically out, like they're, you know, finished with very small number of seats. The center-right New Democracy Party, they also splintered into effectively two parties, although they still came in second. And then, you know, we've talked about this several times now on the show before, but Golden Dawn, the openly neo-Nazi party, now came in third in this election, and, you know, fortunately not higher than that. But that's kind of the big picture question, besides what Syriza ultimately is going to do now that they have power, was, you know, is this election going to break Greece? And so far it looks like it hasn't, but, you know, there's unfortunately still a lot of after effects to be, you know, sorted out. And that's going to be something to continue to keep an eye on in the coming months. There's a lot of obviously pressing questions facing Greece just in the next 6 months or so, various debt payments coming up in March and July. Syriza very opposed to the current regime of debt repayments, and they are probably going to have to, you know, somewhat moderate some of their election rhetoric, but they weren't necessarily all that extreme. You know, they had competed in the European elections earlier this year. They had competed in the 2012 elections in Greece. And then they had led the polling averages, you know, the combined, all the different polls averaged together. They had led every single month from November 2013 to now when they actually won the election. You know, that's over a year of consistently leading the polls, often by a fairly wide margin. And they were running on a pretty, you know, I would argue moderate platform, honestly. I mean, they weren't centrist. They're certainly left-leaning, right? Anti-poverty, social democracy, that sort of thing. But they're also saying, we're pro-Europe. We're pro-European Union. We're pro-Eurozone. We don't want to leave the euro currency, which most Greeks actually don't want to, although there's certainly a significant faction that does. They're also, you know, another sort of more left-leaning thing, saying that they're kind of opposed to NATO. They said that we need to rethink Greece's sort of security positioning and alignments in a post-Cold War environment. You know, the Greek military was a founding partner in NATO originally, but that's been sort of a constant point of conflict due to Turkey also being in it. And so they did end up winning the snap elections, and maybe they're going to change things hugely. Maybe they're going to be kind of frustrated and not have as much success. You know, there's a lot of interesting questions there. And of course, on the other hand, you've also got, yes, this is the country that created the concept of democracy, but they also created oligarchy, aristocracy, monarchy, tyranny. All those words were given to us by the Greeks. And you certainly got to worry when Golden Dawn, the neo-Nazis, who basically are openly anti-democratic, are coming in third. That's a worrying sign, certainly, as well. And Greek democracy in its modern form is just 40 years old. There was a military government up until 40 years ago. Although, at this point, they've had democracy longer than the period between World War II and the dictatorship. But Plato, of course, famously had his theories, along with, you know, Aristotle and some other folks, of the kyklos, the cycle of governance, that said that, you know, it inevitably cycles from democracy to, you know, oligarchy and aristocracy and monarchy and tyranny, and it goes through these various cycles. So, you know, certainly could go in that direction. But in the short term, looks like probably not. So the Syriza formed a coalition government today, as we're recording this on Monday, January 26th. They formed it with the Independent Greeks Party, which was a splinter off of the main center-right party. So the Independent Greeks, they are a right-wing nationalist party, certainly not to the extreme level that Golden Dawn is, but it's certainly troubling. They're aligned with the Orthodox Church, so sort of the Christian conservative equivalent for Greece. They are anti-EU and anti-immigrant, or at least want more immigration controls. But their main point of agreement with Syriza was that they're anti-austerity. And they had explicitly campaigned on the idea of being the junior coalition partner for Syriza. And so with their 13 seats, they put Syriza over the top. Syriza came in just 2 seats short of having an outright majority. And so, you know, the question now is, okay, what's going to happen here? I'm honestly kind of still confused as to how Syriza has come to be deemed radical left by all the media reports, considering that they're, as I said, you know, anti-corruption, anti-tax evasion, pro-Euro, pro-European Union, pro-Europe, pro-growth even. I mean, they want to renegotiate the terms of the debt repayments and make it more growth-oriented than austerity-oriented. But, I mean, you know, I don't know how, you know, the goalposts seem to have been moved so far to the right at this point that this is deemed radical left, even though this honestly seems like pretty mainstream leftist ideology here. So, Nate, what was your reaction to this election in Greece, and what do you think we can expect to see from Syriza at the head of this coalition government with the Independent Greeks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, I guess, you know, encouraging from our perspective. Neither of us are a huge fan of austerity, and I don't think it's worked particularly effectively across Europe. The one thing I would be concerned about is a potential conflict with Germany. And it was, as we've seen, Germany's been extremely involved in sort of the economic bailouts of these parts of Europe that are, you know, struggling in the wake of the economic collapse, are heavily indebted. And, you know, that's always a potential conflict. So as we see, one of the anti-austerity parties, Podemos, now I don't, are they affiliated now or in a coalition with Syriza, or is that not?
No, that's the party that in English is known as the River, and they're not Eurosceptic in the way that you know, the Independent Greeks are. They're very centrist and pro-European, but yeah, they're, I mean, yeah, they're sort of centrist new equivalent, and right. they're brand new. This is their first national
and
election.
And so they tweeted out after the election, Greeks finally have a government, not a Merkel envoy. So
yeah, there was a lot of very explicitly anti-Merkel stuff, mentioning her by name, a lot of political cartoons showing her being, you know, kicked out, like literally, you know, kicked to the butt, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of anger and resentment there. And I would note, in the defense of the Greeks in this case, the German media had been spending weeks and weeks basically berating Greeks on television, saying, you know, you should not vote for Syriza. That would be a huge mistake, which I don't think people really appreciate being told how to vote in their national elections.
No. So, I mean, there is some potential of conflict for that. I mean, obviously, we don't want, you know, sort of these outlying nations in Europe to be sort of economically controlled by Germany. But the fact that, you know, all this has already happened and Germany's already sunk a fair amount of money into these other countries means that there needs to be cooperation between Germany and these governments. So, you know, hopefully there's not like some sort of conflict and they can sort of work together to, you know, they obviously want austerity still in Germany, but if there's a move away from that in a controlled manner, like I don't think the Germans should resist that. I mean, maybe they will, but, you know, I don't think they should. So, you know, we just hope that there can be some constructive dialogue in order to help Greece out of the hole.
Right. It certainly just seems like it would make more sense for Germany to be more, a little bit more flexible. I mean, I think from their perspective, they think they've already been flexible with Greece.
Yeah.
But like, part of the thing that you have to remember here is that, yes, the Greeks did screw up a lot of stuff that got them into this situation. That's definitely true. But on the other hand, there was a lot of stuff that was going on in, you know, the very late 90s as the euro was being introduced, and then into the early 2000s ahead of the Olympics. There was a lot of like really sketchy debt stuff that was happening, and we have evidence that the regulators and stuff at the European Central Bank based in Germany and the various other, you know, German and French folks, they knew a lot of what was going on in Greece. And they didn't say anything. They waited until it was the, you know, the height of this recession to basically express extreme alarm over this situation. And I think that if you're going to have a collective system like the Eurozone and you're going to impose various rules that everyone has to follow, you can't wait to enforce those rules until it's crunch time. Like, you have to be enforcing them earlier than that. And you can't just enforce them on, you know, the littlest countries like Greece and not enforce the rule, you know, when the rules are broken by countries like France. Now, I think Germany tries to push France around, but France is much bigger and doesn't get pushed around very easily, whereas Greece is not in as much of a bargaining position or a position to ignore everyone else. But I feel like if you ignore it for that long, like, you played a part in that. That's a collective failure. And then you can't turn around and demand, you know, immediate, like, super strict reforms and that kind of thing during a recession. I think the priority needs to be to get Greece out of its hole, because it's still very deep in this recession, which was, for, you know, the size of Greece's economy, a much more severe recession than what we even saw in the United States for us. You know, got to get Greece out of that hole and then worry about getting the debt repaid, because otherwise they're just never going to be able to repay that debt. And, you know, then no one's going to be able to have any money for anything, because there's not going to be any economic activity happening, so to speak. There's going to be too much joblessness. There's going to be too much strain on, you know, social programs for the unemployed and the impoverished and things like that. I think that the focus needs to be getting Greece back on, you know, the road to economic recovery, and then deal with the debt problem. And I think that's what Syriza wants to do as well. They're not saying, like, we want to default or we want to leave the euro. They're saying we want to have a more sensible strategy for getting out of this problem.
Yeah, and just, I think the main key to that will just be a cooperation with the larger economic powers in Europe, so that, you know, you're still receiving that assistance and you sort of aren't cut off, but in a way that's just, you know, not able to lead to a conflict where, you know, Greece is, you know, openly defying the Germans' wishes and the Germans are like having angry press conferences about it. You just don't want that sort of conflict to be there, because that makes it even more difficult. So we're just going to have to hope that, you know, Germany will be able to work with them. And I just wanted to make a larger point, and we were just talking about this a little before the podcast, but it seems like, you know, just in terms of Germany and Germany now being sort of thrust into a leadership role in Europe, it seems like it's all sort of flipped in the past 20 years where, you know, Berlin Wall coming down, Germany is sort of divided, reclusive. You know what I'm saying? Like, they didn't really feel like the center of the European Union in sort of its early era. 20 years later, I mean, it kind of seems like it's Germany's Europe again. I mean, they're the most dominant economic country in the area. They're having all this influence on all these other countries. You know, it seems like they're taking a little bit of a more political role in the EU.
And also, even in situations like Ukraine, that's a political and security thing, too.
And just, you know, completely not related to politics or security, just the World Cup in terms of Germany and their soccer team sort of rising to prominence. It just sort of seems, and this is, you know, not exactly related to Greece, but it just sort of seems like over the past 10, 15 years, Germany has sort of undergone maybe a little bit of a, I wouldn't say a renaissance, but it just sort of seems refreshed a little bit. It's just different and moving forward towards sort of a new 21st century Europe. And even this, you know, we're into the second half of the second decade of the 21st century now. And it just sort of seems like Germany's now emerging as sort of a key player now in a way that it was subdued, obviously, for the past, you know, half century or so.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me this week to talk about these issues.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.